Well, no, but I just mean like in general. Like, I just have dogs. I've seen their dicks. Like, it's just, it's. Okay. So, I mean,
also- there's the intro.
What I'm saying.
What was it? I didn't even hear.
No, I mean just in general, dogs. I've seen their dicks. It's a thing.
Well, like everyone, you've seen a dog's dick, right, Chris? I'm just asking. Oh, not the only one, right? You got into one. Here, watch. Chris will back me up. You've seen a dog's dick, right?
Yeah, I've seen a dog's dick.
You ever seen a cat's dick?
No, man. I've never seen
it. See? Me either. I've never seen a cat's dick. And then he's acting like that's all weird. I'm like, well, I've seen a dog's dick. Like, it's...
Noah's back. Hi, Noah.
Hi. How you guys doing? Okay. All right. So let's get into this. Okay. So first, I have a bone to pick with you guys.
Hang on. Whoa. Okay. Whoa. What's this? What do you got? Breaking beard news over here?
While we're doing the show, yeah. I'm going to update my phone to Android 7 because I finally got it.
Jeez. Android 7. Didn't that come out in fall?
Yep.
You have an S6 too. How are you now getting S7?
I just got Nougat right now.
So to get a live report from the beard on how his live Nougat upgrade goes. You have a bone to pick with us.
I have a bone to pick with you guys. So what? I learned two very important lessons last week. The first lesson is, if you want to have really good content for a show like User Error, then climb into a vehicle and drive for 26 hours, because the amount of thoughts that go through your head when you're on the road are amazing. Yeah. And so as long as you document all those, then you're set, right?
Noah, let me correct you. If you want to have really good content for User, you just skip a week.
Okay, so that was the second thing. You actually jumped ahead, but that was my second conclusion. My second conclusion was, this show would be, I think, super, super awesome if we just accept that we're going to have 1 week of a really awesome show, and then another week of just we got to build the content back up, and then another week of a really awesome show, and then if we alternated like that, because what I'm finding is, like, every other episode I have like every episode I have just enough stuff to kind of like, you know, pepper the episode, but if I saved it all up for a whole week, then I could just blow the load on one episode. It would be amazing. But let me get to the bone that I want to pick with you guys. So I'm driving and I'm thinking about all these things, and I started having this conversation in my head about things that are modular. So for example, in the first thing that occurred to me is rack units. So in IT and in audio, we have this very standard rack unit, which is exactly, 1.75 inches. And then they make equipment that is this exact dimension. And then we have, cases that we can put these equipment in. So, like, for example, when I was headed down to Self, I just took the equipment out of the rack that I was using here in Grand Forks, some spare stuff, and I put it into a little mobile rack and then just brought it with me. And I could do that because all of this stuff is standard. And then I started thinking about how great it is that Pelican makes all of these standard size cases. And so I have one case for all of my Ask Noah stuff. And then I have another case for all of the video streaming stuff. And then I have another case for, and I have all these modular cases. And so when I was getting ready to go to Self, having built these up over a series of years, I just went, okay, I want to do video streaming, take that one. I want to do interviews, take the interview case. I want to do Ask Noah, take that case, throw them all in the RV, and I drive. And as I get onto the road and I start thinking, I'm so proud of myself. Noah, you are so smart. Having all these different cases, having everything just ready to go, everything so modular and easy to assemble. And oh, you're so smart. And nobody really understands how smart you really are except you. And then as I turn on User Error, I listen to a conversation about you guys talking about go bags. And I'm like, I have the coolest go bag!
Now, I've been led to believe there is a hell of a story involving some sort of vehicle malfunction. In fact, it's a hell of a story. It sounds like you weren't even sure you wanted to share it. Now, I really want to hear it.
All right, then I have to share it. Here's the thing. The User Error show is a show of ebb and flow. So every once in a while, when I don't share a story that I don't want to share, then the next week I feel like I'm compelled to. So,
So you mean like, so does that mean like in the back of my mind, I got to be aware that there is, I got a hedge. Like, there is a story currency at play here, and I got to decide if I want to spend it on the story this week or if I want to save and hope for the story next.
Something like that. But I tell you what, this is currency well spent, because, This is a heck of a story. So
wait, no, hold on. Stop right there. That's a good tease. I feel like we should do like a little teasing in the show. We'll tease that. So we're going to get the story. about how apparently everything went wrong on the way. We were driving. You were
well. Didn't you hear, Chris?
With Noah, the family.
Noah just said that he has to save for a week and blow his load immediately.
Yeah, I know. So we're now. I'm gonna make him wait. I'm gonna make him just wait.
We're edging.
Okay. Now tell us. Now tell us.
There, okay. All right, okay. So before I leave, I was going to take my wife's truck instead of my Jeep down because we're driving very long distance and she has a full size truck and you know it's just easier to pull it with that than it is to pull with my little Jeep. So I'm gonna take her truck. So I take it over to my friend who's a mechanic. I take it into a shop and I said, check this vehicle out. Make sure that it's ready for a 3,000-mile drive. So he puts it up on a hoist and he checks all the coolant lines and he checks all the fluids and he listens to the engine. He's one of those guys that he can take the oil out and he can rub it in his hand. He can see if there's like, you know, grit from the engine or what, like he's really smart. And so he looks at all the stuff and he goes, yep. And so he finds a few little things here and there and goes, we'll fix this. We'll fix that. Okay. You're good to go. I'm like, all right. So get on the road and I drive. And the first, I'd say 800 miles, no problem. Everything's great. And I stop at a Waffle House because anytime you are in the South, you have to eat at a Waffle House.
Get some chicken and waffles.
I didn't get chicken and waffles, actually. I thought about it, but I didn't do it. And so I'm at Waffle House. And as soon as I pull into the parking lot, I get ding, 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 low coolant. And I thought, well, that's strange. So I open the hood because I'm going to stay on top of vehicle maintenance through this whole trip. And that will ensure that everything goes smoothly. So I open the hood and I look and there's plenty of coolant in the coolant reservoir. But then again, I'm not a mechanic. I don't really know that that's enough coolant. So I take a picture of it and I send it to my friend. Hey, what does this look like to you? He goes, meh, looks fine. Might be a little low. He's like, just splash some coolant in there. You'll be fine. Okay.
Just go ahead.
Splash it. Yeah. Go to the store, splash a little coolant in there, put the cap back on, start driving. Another 200 miles, no problem. All of a sudden, I'm driving down the interstate and the car goes, ding, 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 ding. And I look down and there's this message. Everything on the dash is just flashing. And there's this big message. It says, engine overheating. Stop now. Stop now. I'm like, oh God. Oh God. So I'm in the center lane and I'm like, oh God. So I screech to the right and I'm like, oh, I hope I don't hit anyone. Oh, the trailer's back there. Oh geez. Okay. Stop and shut the engine off. And I'm like, okay. All right. We did that in like 15 seconds. That was intense. And so now my next thought is, don't panic. So I have a friend that's a pilot and his big
thing. Hold on, stop there. I went through something similar and I would like to know from the audience. That's why I paused you. If your engine is overheating and assuming that your fans are still working, is it better to pull over on the side of the road and leave your engine running? So that way the coolant system is still running and the fans are still going? Or because here's my thinking is if you turn it off, and it's super crazy overheated, there's nothing – and imagine it's hot, you're in Texas, something like that. There's nothing cooling the engine at that point.
However, also nothing generating more heat, though.
Yeah, I understand. But still, it's like – it seems like if you remove all load from the engine except for idle and you have the cooling system running
– if your cooling system is working properly, your engine should never overheat.
It's like, right, but that's true. Okay, that's a good point. But it's sort of like I used to have some PCs that when you would shut them down, like the power supply fan would run for like another 15 seconds after you shut the PC down, so that way the components would properly cool.
Yeah, my motorcycle does that too. The cooling fan will run for a little bit. No, my suggestion would be if your engine is too warm, you can do two things. Either shut the engine down. The other thing you can do if you want to keep it, if you want to still have some cooling mechanism going on, in a lot of vehicles you can actually turn the heater on. And the blower motor for
the
heater.
Is that true anymore, though? I've heard that in the old.
It depends on the vehicle because a lot of new ones have like special heating elements that are behind, so it's not blowing across the engine anymore to take the heat away. But
you remember on when I left to go to your place on my first big road trip.
Your water pump went out, right?
The water pump I think went out just because the hoses blew out and then it was sitting there running dry. But so it was like a symptom of the problem. But yeah, I guess some hoses ripped or something happened that caused a cascade of failures as I was going up down the freeway. Actually, it was going up a hill, and the least of which was that we got coolant all over the engine, and then it came out like either the exhaust. It's like somehow something happened where it either came out the exhaust or came out the back, and it went all over the trailer. Just so
you're hindering my story. So
can I rewind for a moment?
Yeah, sure.
Noah was talking about car problems, and then he started to transition to something about.
His engine overheating.
No, his friend, the pilot.
Yes. Yeah, right. So let me pick that up. So what Alex has always taught me is anytime you are in a stressful situation, no matter what the problem is, the first thing you do is set your watch. Because if you, in his world, he's making decisions about the lives of everyone on board an airplane. If you don't have the mental composure to make sure that your watch is set to the correct time, you definitely don't have any business making decisions that are going to affect the outcome of everyone's life on board, right? So his big thing is, anytime you're in a stressful situation, take just 5 or 10 seconds and collect your thoughts. So that's the first thing I'm doing on the side of the road. I'm like, okay. So I know that the engine is overheated, and obviously there's, you know, smoke is pouring out the hood, and I'm not too bothered by that because I realize that there's probably antifreeze all over. So I pop the hood, look, and I'm looking around, and like you said, antifreeze everywhere, all over the engine, all over the underside of the car, all over the trailer, all over the hitch. Everything is covered in antifreeze. And so I take a picture of the underside of the hood, and I send it to my friend, and I said, you know, I wonder what blew off here. I wonder what happened. And I sent it to him, and he says, oh, it's the hose that went to your heater core that came off. I said, oh, okay. So, you know, I'm thinking, I'm a relatively smart guy. I can fix things. Could I just get some antifreeze, fill the tank back up, and shove that hose back on? And he goes, yeah, it sounds like it'd be that simple, but it's not. You need special tools to get these clamps and stuff off. He's like, there's no way you're going to do that on the side of the road. He's like, I have a hard time doing it. I do it 15 times a day. And he goes, and add to that, if it came off, there's these little plastic clips that the thing goes onto, and I'll bet you those plastic clips are damaged, so you're going to need those replaced. Okay, all right, so I'm going to have to get a tow. Well, I sit back into the car, and because the car has been off now for maybe 5 or 10 minutes, my kids are starting to freak out. Dad, it's hot in here. Dad, I'm hungry. Dad, I want this. Dad, I want that. Okay, all right, you know what? Everyone shut up. And I go get an Uber, and I'm like, okay, Sarah, you and the kids go to the mall, do something, go have fun. Just, I need you off the side of the interstate and out of my hair so I can think and process through this.
Where about, what's your location?
1 mile outside of Knoxville. I can see the exit. Like, in fact, I am having an internal debate with myself of if I want to, you know, once the engine cools back down, even though there's no coolant in it, I could run, you know, it's back down to 160. Now I could warm it back up to 250 and kind of limp myself along, because I literally have a couple hundred feet to go.
Yeah, I did that a little bit. I was on the side of the freeway, and I waited, and then I let the engine cool down, and then I went, because I was just 100 yards from an off-ramp, and so you just couldn't, you know, it was the same situation. Like, you want to get off the road as fast as possible because everything's blowing up and there's smoke coming out. So I got it, I cooled it, and then I started it back up, and I drove it up the off-ramp, which was a hill, and I got to the top of the off-ramp, and by the time I even made it to the top of the top, which couldn't have been more than 400 or 500 yards.
Yes.
It was already completely max overheated, shut everything down, all over.
Yeah, I was in the same boat. But when I asked my friend, I said, you know, do you think, and he's like, you know what, dude, it just isn't worth a motor. It's going to be $100 to get it towed. Just don't even screw with it. I'm like, okay, all right.
Yeah. So probably when Uber, I killed my water pump right there.
Uber pulls up. Actually, it probably didn't. And I'll tell you why in a second. So Uber pulls up, takes Sarah and the kids. They go to a mall. They're good. Okay, now I'm good. So now I call a tow truck. Now, in the back of my mind, I'm playing this conversation that I had with a good friend of mine who was coming to see me in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and his truck blew up, and he said that he had to specify that he had a truck and a trailer. So I tell the tow truck driver, I have a 19-foot trailer, and I have a full-size truck. So I'm going, you can't send me a little snatch truck. I need a full-on flatbed. Okay, no problem, sir. All right, you sure you're going to bring me like a, you know, 30, 40-foot bed? Yeah, no problem. We got that. Okay, great. Hang up. Guy shows up. Tiny little 15-foot truck. I'm like, so, about all that conversation about how I have the trailer? He's like, yeah, well, fortunately, we don't have nothing bigger. I'm like, okay, well, what are we going to do? And he's like, yeah, I'm not real sure. And I'm like, okay, here's what we'll do. I'll drop the trailer. We'll leave the trailer by the side of the road. And then you take the truck into town. And he goes, yeah, we're not going to be able to do that. That's going to be a road hazard, having that trailer on the side of the road there. Well, and the truck and the trailer are on the side of the road, that, sir, would be a hazard as well, right? So it'd be infinitely less of a hazard to just have the trailer on the side of the road. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to. You're going to have to move that trailer. Well, do you want me to get behind and push it to the next exit? Like, how do I move it? I don't know. So I get back in my car. I'm starting to think, what am I going to do? How am I going to move this trailer? So I call U-Haul. Hey, you guys rent pickups. You got anything with a hitch? She goes,
smart.
Well, sir, we don't have any pickups for rent. But we have a 30-foot box truck, and that has a hitch, and we'll give it to you for the same price as the pickup. All right, I'll be there in 10 minutes. Get another Uber, get into town, I pick up this 30-foot box truck. Now, to put this into perspective for me, the trailer is 19 feet. So sitting next to it on this 30-foot box truck, I could have put the camper inside of the box truck. It was so big. But I hook this trailer up to the box truck. I follow the guy to the auto store, drop the trailer off. The guy is super nice guy, Precision Auto Tune, I think it was. And And the guy starts working on it. Okay, we're going to get it fixed. I take the U-Haul back. I Uber back over to the auto place. And then I'm waiting for it to get done. And I'm like, you know, I haven't showered yet today. I haven't eaten yet today. And my camper's sitting right there. So I just go out to his lot. I walk in my camper, start the water heater up, go take a shower, eat some lunch, get done, walk back in. He kind of does one of those double takes, like you're in a different change of clothes and you don't look grungy anymore. And the car is fixed and I'm back on the road. So that should be the end of the story, right? That should be great. And then the rest of the self was fantastic. Not quite. So I make it all the way to Charlotte, drop the camper off, go to sleep.
Good.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that was a good part. Next morning, I wake up. I go to the conference, say hi to everyone. Everyone says, "Hey, you want to get lunch? Yeah, let's go for lunch." All right, great. So we all pile in to the truck.
Drive
to lunch. The bunch of people himself get to lunch, and on the way there, I hear this squealing noise. Squeal. What was that? It sounds like a belt or something. So I telegram my friend.
Where'd you go for lunch?
It was really good, by the way.
Oh, okay.
So I telegram my friend. I said, "Hey, do you have this squealing?" He goes, "Yeah, it's probably just antifreeze got on the belt." Well, that's weird. I drove 900 miles and I didn't get any antifreeze on the belt.
But, you know, that stuff's resistant. Maybe that's
exactly. Yeah, that. And the other thing was, it was everywhere. So the thought that maybe it dripped down afterwards is not out of the question. Okay, totally. So I get to the restaurant and I shut the car off and I thought, I'm going to double check on this antifreeze situation. I opened the hood up. I didn't even have to because antifreeze is just pouring out the bottom of the truck.
No.
Well, this time I am a little more concerned because the first time, within the first 5 minutes, we knew it was a hose. I knew it was going to be no big deal. This time I'm thinking the head gasket went. That's where all this antifreeze is coming from. And so I'm like, you know what, whatever. I'm hungry. And so we all go in. We sit down for lunch. I call this great guy. His name was Rusty. I call Rusty and I said, you know, would you be able to fix this? He's like, listen, it's the weekend and I'm closing at 5. So if you get it here in the next hour, maybe I'll be able to do something about it. Otherwise, you're going to have to wait till next week. Well, that's not going to work because I have a radio show to do on Monday. So I call this tow truck company. And I'm like, listen, I need you to get the car from here over to there within the next hour. He's like, no problem. We're going to make that happen. So the dude shows up in like 40 minutes. And this is like, he's like the world's best tow truck driver ever. Like he's super careful and he's, you know, but he's expedient. And we get the thing up. I jump in, we run over to the auto store, drop the truck off. He pulls it in. He looks and he goes, it's your water pump. So what happened was, like you said, the engine heated up. When the engine heated up, it destroyed that seal around the water pump. Then the water pump, started leaking. So, and then I told the story on Ask Noah, but basically he originally told me, he's like, there's no way we can fix it today. It's too many man hours. And I explained, and I'm doing the show and I got to be on the road and all this stuff. And he goes, all right. So he puts two guys on it to make sure that it gets done in like half the amount of time. And we get the water pump and, you know, from then on it was smooth sailing, made it all the way home, no problems. And I expect to make it to Montana with no problems. But needless to say, you know, here's the takeaway from it. Here's the takeaway. When I know that there is nothing on the line, when it just affects me, when it's not somebody else's schedule, when it's not somebody else's, when it's not a client's money, when it's just me that's affected, problem solving is fun. The idea of sitting back in my truck and going, okay, I have to get this trailer and I don't have any way to move it. Where can I get a truck to move? Oh, U-Haul would rent, you know, and go stepping through that thing. My kids and my wife are on the side of the road. I don't want them here. How can I get them? Oh, I can use Uber and get them into town and then they can go do, you know, whatever. And then I can sit here and fix this stuff. And walking through that mental exercise of problem solving is actually really fun when there aren't a ton of consequences, you know, attached to it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little more stressful when it's your home on the side of the road.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I'm glad that Rusty guy seemed to work out. That was a good story.
Oh, he's fantastic. If he was a mechanic in Grand Forks, I'd be using him.
So I want to talk more about some interviews you did recently. But before we go too far, you just name dropped Montana in there. You and I are going to be going to Montana in the middle of July. And we're going to be in the Bozeman area. So I started, you know how I roll. I started just doing quick cursor searches. Cursory? Is that right?
Cursory.
Thank you, sir. Cursory searches for Linux activity in the Bozeman area.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered there is a Bozeman lug.
Nice.
And they meet monthly, it looks like. And I wonder if maybe they'd be interested in chatting with us. So I don't know if anybody listens from the Bozeman Lug, which is probably a long shot. So I might try to get a hold of them. It might be fun to do like take one day and go do some Linux stuff. Because I was also digging around.
For sure.
there's a couple of businesses in Bozeman, too, like data miners over there, which sounds interesting. There's also the Montana State University in Bozeman, which uses some Linux, or quite a bit of Linux. So there's a few companies over there, too, running Linux that I thought maybe we could end up going and chatting with. So, I mean, I know it's a vacation, but if we're in the area and we had a day and there was some Linux going on, I mean, that might be kind of fun to go check it out, don't you think?
Yeah, let me tell you, if there's anyone that you're going to have a really hard time convincing to take some time during his vacation and go talk about some Linux, that's going to be me. I mean, that's just something I'm totally against. So good luck with that.
Yeah, so if anybody in the Bozeman area, which is probably, I don't know how many listeners we have in Bozeman, but or in that general area that knows about any Linux stuff going on or knows how to get in touch with Ken Dyke, the founder of the Bozeman Lug, which I guess has been around since 2001. How about that? They meet on a monthly basis, usually the first Tuesday of the month, which is not when we're going to be there. I don't know. I think that's awesome.
There's going to be some guy that's going to write in, and he's going to be like, "I'm the one. I'm the listener in Bozeman."
I see. They have an IRC. I could probably go. Lurk in and probably talk to somebody. So that's kind of I'm hoping to even when we go out and have some fun, I'm hoping to work in a little Linux. And you know, if everybody's either people could join us, the family could join us, or we could make sure they're entertained and go geek out. last.ting.com. Go to ting.com and check out their no plan setup. It's really simple. You just pay for what you use, $6 a month for the line, and then your minutes, your messages, and your megabytes on top of that. Whatever you use, that's what you pay for. Just go to last.ting.com. We will eventually change that. I was considering, should we just consolidate it all to linux.ting.com?
What about why does our audience hate us? .ting.com?
Why won't they keep us going? Oh my God, if you don't go there, this show dies. Don't you love us?
Well, no, I was thinking more like, why aren't they suggesting things to us? .ting.com?
Oh, wow. You know, they really don't like it when you try to shame them. Even though we do it in jest, some people, they don't catch the sarcasm because there's no sarcasm.
Oh, no, no. I'm not being sarcastic. I'm serious. I'm shaming the hell out of them. These people are selfish.
.com. It's an ad read, Rika. It is an ad read and it's staying an ad read. You know what's great about Ting? It's on Rikai's phone right now that's updating to the Nuggets or whatever it is.
Yeah, Ting has a $6 keep beard happy fee.
Yeah, that's nice. It is. I pay that happily every single month. What
I don't use much data.
What's the status of your Nugget update there?
I appear to be updated.
Ooh, very good. last.ting.com. It's no contract, no early termination fee. You only pay for what you use. You can bring a phone. Like, I already had that phone. I got it on another GSM carrier, and then I just went in there and was like, you know what? I'm done with you guys. I'm actually switching to a different phone. Got that off that GSM carrier, put it on the Ting network the next day, and now it's been beards for a while, and it's a great phone. And you know, you can bring a budget phone, you can go get a Cadillac, whatever you want will work on the Ting network. That just make it very simple. There's no weird, mysterious contracts. And if you want to bring a device, check their BYOD page. Just go to last.ting.com. A big thank you to Ting for sponsoring User Air. last.ting.com.
One of the things I came to the realization of, and I'm really interested to get Beard's take on this, and of course Chris's as well, is oftentimes in the world, I think what we have is a lot of different communities. And sometimes when we're a part of one community for so long, we just get the idea that that's the only community that exists, and that everything that's the only world that exists is our particular community, because we get this egocentric view of like, this is where we live, and so this is what we see, and so this must be the way the world works. And then every once in a while you have a chance to step outside of that into another community, and you go, wait a minute, there's a whole other world of thousands of people that are doing something completely different. And I'll bring it home and tell you what I'm talking about. It is the difference between the conferences that we go to where there are all of these developers on MacBooks versus things like Self and Red Hat, basically the entire state of North Carolina. All of these places, and South Carolina, so Spartansburg, all of these guys are living in an entirely different reality than the reality that we see on the West Coast. And I'm interested if how as a human beings do we process that? This idea that, you know, there's these two separate worlds and you can go from one to the other. And in one, you know, both of them kind of seem to think that they have a different perception of how the world is.
Well, I tend to just think that different people prefer different things. And I also don't really ascribe to the idea that people necessarily isolate themselves as communities. Like me personally, I'm in, what, 200 different IRC channels and like 50 different Discord groups, all for different topics. And I have no problem.
I see it as tribes. So when you what you call communities, I call tribes, I think.
Yeah.
And I think there is tribal wisdom and there is a tribal narrative that does exist. And I think there's also a bit of industry difference. Mm-hmm. So some industries have more prominence in more media-centric or media – more. Let me re-say this. Let's see. What's a better way to say this? I think also what's at play here is there's different communities – or not the word – I think another thing at play here is these different tribes are in different industries potentially. So some out here on the coast are in industries that get covered more heavily by the media or are considered mm-hmm. more influential, quote unquote. And so there is more discussion about the hardware and tools they're using because they're often seen as maybe people on the trailing edge of a trend or mm-hmm. the beginning edge of a trend, right? Whereas people maybe more in the quote unquote flyover states are considered to be at the trailing edge of a trend or maybe in a, you know, different use cases. I don't sure. know if any of that's true, but I'm just trying to say, I think that could also contribute to the amount of discussion about the tools that all these guys at DockerCon are on MacBooks and all these right. guys at DrupalCon are on MacBooks and yeah, look yeah. at all these MacBooks at OSCON, right? But those are all coastal events.
Yeah, that's a good point. So the coastal events, and I think you're right. I think it comes down to a lot of media attention, or where the media drive is, where the buzz is, you know, so to speak. But because it's interesting, because you would get the idea from going to some of these conferences that the majority of developers are using MacBooks, and then what you find is actually there are hundreds of thousands of developers that are not using MacBooks at all. In fact, there are entire companies that are not using MacBooks or entire conferences that ban MacBooks, and it's interesting to just kind of watch that difference because,
well,
you know, again,
if you zoom out one level from that, there are a galaxy full of developers using Windows laptops.
We talked about that, right?
Yeah, it makes all these other developers seem tiny. So it really does depend on which tribe you're looking into.
Yes, yes.
I think
an interesting realization, though, that I had was going from one world and stepping into another world, and then it becomes – it was kind of a sigh of relief because I basically kind of accepted you get to choose – I'll use your word. You get to choose what tribe you want to live in. You get to choose what tribe you want to be a part of.
Can I challenge that for a second?
Sure.
Can I suggest to you that it's also potentially that in certain tribes, your equipment has a different level of personal importance to you? So a lot of times tribal members will associate themselves with the tools that they use. So, you know, this phone represents my choices as a geek. This mm-hmm. laptop represents my priorities and, mm-hmm. and my choices as a geek. And so the different tribes have different priorities. So
yeah.
there's some tribes that will ascribe more importance to these gadgets, and there are other tribes that will ascribe less importance. So
yeah.
I guess I can see that.
Like the guy at Starbucks, he doesn't really care if he has all the latest apps or all the coolest features. He just wants to be able to text message and call people. And so
yeah,
and if you're using an iPhone, it's fine.
Well, yeah, like in his tribe, if he's not a particularly strong technical circle too, it'd be totally fine for him to have, you know, a first or second gen smartphone,
right?
With, you know, people don't really care. Like
yep,
it's just
yep.
not, and that isn't a judgment call. That is just
yeah.
to them
a difference of priorities, right?
Exactly.
It's, you know, it's interesting you say that because that actually has a whole different. I have a whole different realm of that, or different take on that, so to speak. And that is that I've often thought about what happens when I exit the IT world because I think. I've accepted myself, and I think I know we joke about it all the time. I don't know how serious you are about this, but I've kind of resigned myself to being very serious that I will eventually leave this IT space. And the more quickly some of these trends continue, like you know, Nihilus, for example, the more quickly that the way I like to do things on technology dies off, the faster that's going to push me out of the industry, I think. And one of the things that I've thought about is if I wasn't a part of this, if I wasn't living it day to day, how would that affect my choices? How would that affect, you know, what I would do? And that's been an interesting thought experiment too, because one of the things I've been very thankful for is I think I would get rid of the internet. I think I would, that would be the first thing I would do. If I move out to, you know, the middle of nowhere and live in a hut, and then, I think and I would get rid of the internet.
You'd have less signals coming into your life. And you would
I'd have less signals, but the other thing is I would be less dependent on anything or anyone. Sure. I wouldn't have to worry about these changes, like, because they no longer affect me.
I feel like this makes you a huge hypocritical jerk, like a huge hypocritical jerk. Because a couple of weeks ago, I was trying to explain to you that, well, you know, now that I'm not doing less, I feel like I have to reevaluate all of my technology decisions, because there were so many choices I made in the past where the bullet point would be, is it functional? Will it make good show content for the Linux Action Show? Will it give me more experience and commentary for the Linux Action Show? And if it checks those boxes, I would go with it. And now those boxes don't exist anymore, and I'm having to choose my technology on a totally different set of requirements. And I tried to express that to you, and you just totally steamrolled me about it, and we're not sympathetical to it at all.
No,
and
I don't think
you are reflecting on the same thing.
If I'm going to exist in the technology space, I want to make a specific kind of technology choice. So, for example, if I'm going to use a laptop, it's going to be Linux. And we could spend the next hour talking about why that is or why that isn't, to go back and forth. And we all know the arguments for and about. But suffice to say that's a static. And what I'm talking about is getting away from computers altogether. I'm talking about getting rid of internet, getting rid of computers, and just going to having a simple TV with some local media on my Western Digital Lives, and being able to just queue that up and sit there and water ski and sit in the outdoors cabin. And be away from all this stuff. And, you know, I'll tell you, a big push of this is I watch some of the industries that we work in, and the way that they're able to survive on 25-year-old technology on Windows NT or even older. And I think to myself, why couldn't that be me? If I was disconnected from the internet, why couldn't I just take whatever static release of Ubuntu there is, or, you know, 14.04, 16.04, whatever it is, and just live on that for the next 25 years. And when that computer dies, then find a way to get it to run on a different one, because all the software is there that I want to use, and I could just be disconnected from the world. And to me, that's like the ultimate paradise, to be just totally disconnected and relaxed and not moving, not changing.
Hey, Noah, I think back in Maine, I have some Apple IIs in storage that I could send you.
Actually, dude, first of all, it might be worth some money, so you might want to look into that. But if you have an Apple IIe, as long as you have, what's the Oregon Trail? As long as you have Oregon Trail, I'm all in.
Hi, that's awesome. Nice. You know, okay, I got a suggestion for you. I don't mean to probe, but you activated them with your comments. You've triggered my probes. I would tell you that this is your subconscious telling you you need to pull back now.
No, because there's a couple of things.
Here's what I suggest to you is that perhaps by fantasizing about this one day, I'm going to finally just completely go all disconnected, it allows you to continue suffering today, which is sort of delaying gratification as long as you can grind it out now. And I would suggest to you that perhaps you could refactor that and go, well, maybe I should just slow down now and pace myself.
Maybe. Here's the thing. First of all, it's not where we are today that concerns me. It's where we are going. And here's the other thing, too. I have a feeling, and I could be wrong about this. This might be totally out in left field. But I have a feeling that these trends in technology, which I think are very, very dangerous, I think they are going to come and bite people in a big way. And once that happens, I think we're going to see a major, major shift back to, okay, we're done. I don't know what it's going to be, but I think there's going to be some big event.
I thought that, you know, and that big event came and went, and nothing's really changed. Things improved, but things just they don't reset. So
Maybe we're talking on a different scale. I mean something on the scale of World War II internment kind of a thing, but yeah, facilitated by technology.
No, I'm just saying you can take from history things that should have been huge red flags and sort of project forward. And I would say what you generally have is a continuation of what worked, and they just modify it. But we'll see. You might be, you know, yeah, maybe. If you go all doomsday on us, yeah, maybe something.
Well, anyway, so that's one of my thoughts. The other thing is, like I said, like, I enjoy what I do, you know, at the moment. I just look ahead to a time where nobody owns any computers. They're all dumb clients that talk up to a cloud, and they're managed by some large company outside of New York.
Hey, Noah. All right, Noah, it's all right.
Noah,
it's okay.
Noah,
it's okay,
Noah, remember that conversation earlier about how you didn't like to hear other people's dreams? Because
this isn't a dream. This is, I'm watching this happen.
Totally a dream.
Well,
this isn't a dream. I'm watching it happen.
I'll be there camping on your property.
Yeah, exactly. No, listen, I'm pouring two slabs. I'll pour one for me and one for you.
I think the solution is, Noah, is you got to pick the right leap time, and then you make the leap and you come out here and you just go full-time Jupiter Broadcasting in studio, and you transition out of IT and you become a broadcaster, and then you can just be crotchety commentary on the way everything's going and still make a buck off of it.
That's what happens to use a Mac, though.
And then we'll do.
Wait, why would you have to use a Mac? We just switch everything to Linux.
Yeah, and you know what else?
I'm all in the.
I'll tell you this too. We would have a hell of a vlog. We could have a hell of a vlog. This place with you here and the beard here and me, we could be vlogging this place.
Here's my first thing as the on-site co-host or whatever of JB. The first thing I would do is I'm buying cameras and putting them in every room other than the bathrooms.
Yeah. It really is fun.
As long as it's after I move out of the studio.
Well, you mean we could still have a review process where everyone gets final say before the footage gets published?
Right.
But sometimes there are things.
You know what? That's maybe a whole other topic, and maybe we say this for another time, but I am never afraid to say anything on mic around you guys or on video, because I know that if I ask something not to get aired, it won't get aired. And it's interesting, because that is a level of trust that you couldn't just say it's our policy that X, and then all of a sudden everyone would do that, right? Like you have to really buy into it and believe it before that becomes a thing. But because of it, I don't even have a filter. I just say whatever's coming through my head, and then we just figure it out later. DigitalOcean.com and use the promo code Here's the Thing to get $10 off your first Linux rig. I use DigitalOcean for practically everything we do at AltaSpeed. Their ability to make images, send those snapshots around to other customers, and then those customers send it back, and we make some changes and finally put that into production. Amazing. And one of the things that I think is not as well advertised as it could be is their backups. So if you have a backup that will make an image of a particular server, you can delete all of your servers but one and store the backups from every one of those servers. So we have built up kind of like a repository of images of how we have different servers connected. We're not paying anything to have all those images stored on DigitalOcean. Then when a customer needs it, we just take that image, spin it up, send a copy to them, and they're ready to go. DigitalOcean.com, use the code Here's the Thing to get $10 off your first Linux rig.
I hope none of my family hears this part of the show, because I have not been able to tell them something that's affecting me almost on a daily basis. And it causes a near panic attack in me. I'm not going to say it's a full panic attack, but I definitely start really considering, how do I get out of this situation? What's the fastest way to get them to stop? I can't handle this. What do I do? Like those thoughts start crossing my mind. And it's always been a thing of mine for about 15 years. And it's when people try to tell me about their dreams. Like first thing in the morning, I just woken up and my kids or a significant other describes what a fantastical dream they've had in vivid detail, and with high emotional elements to the description that are exciting and romantic, and there's moments that are challenging and scary, and
it's not real.
And they go on and on. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do, because it drives me nuts. It's like, first of all, I'm glad that you had a great experience, but I didn't.
I have a question.
Okay.
Do you remember your dreams, Noah?
Oh, absolutely. I just don't talk about them because they didn't happen. They're dreams.
I don't, very rarely. Maybe a couple a year, a few a year.
I don't either, and I feel like that's why I also have kind of similar
part of it.
Panic issues to you.
But it's sort of like it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it causes anxiety to you?
Well, it makes me think about why can these people dream and remember all these amazing things, and every time I wake up, I can't remember anything?
But you're not remembering anything because it didn't happen. Well, yeah.
But you remember the dream, Noah. But I feel like because I don't remember that stuff, there must be something wrong with my brain, and that sends me in a whole different direction.
See, I think it could actually be the opposite, because when you're in REM sleep, your long-term memory shuts down. And so the more detail you would seem to recall about a dream, to me, that would imply the less sleep you were having, the less
detail. That explains so much.
So to me, and it's interesting, Noah, because I don't know if does Sarah sometimes describe a dream to you, and does it cause anxiety?
I don't get anxiety. I just feel like I just feel like when people describe dreams, I kind of feel like it's sort of like I feel like they're on the same level as my kids describing their imaginary world in the living room. Like, mm-hmm. it's cute when it's a 5-year-old, but like when a 30-something adult or 40-something adult is telling me the thing that didn't happen that their mind created while they were asleep, like it's straight out of the book of I don't care. Like I said, I don't mean to be mean about it, 30. I just don't care.
That's somewhat different for me, though. I actually do like listening to people's dreams because it kind of gives you a peek into their psyche. And I don't know, that just appeals to me.
Yeah,
if my psyche is being judged by my dreams, we got problems.
You have problems.
Yeah, I can actually, I do see that's, but that's part of the problem is so when somebody is describing a dream to me, multiple threads in my mind that I have no control over, especially in the morning, kick off.
You start psychoanalyzing.
Exactly.
Them.
One is psychoanalyzing. What does every single one of these things mean? And what does that tell me about this person? Then I start questioning myself. Why don't I have these dreams? Why don't I remember them? And then I start, how do I stop this conversation? How do I get out of this? And it becomes this loop that first thing in the morning actually is like this weird thing.
Overwhelming.
Where like, it's overwhelming. Like I'm like, I got to sit up. I got to just breathe for a second and calm down. This is ridiculous. I want to know if anybody in the audience can share any insights in what this is about and why and if they get this way and if they've mastered this. Because I don't want to – and the reason why I haven't told anyone in my family is I don't want to be like, shut the hell up. I don't want to hear this. Like I don't want to be – I want to be like, well,
it's their good thing. You don't want to ruin it for
exactly.
them.
So I just sit there and I listen and I don't really express any frustration or anything because I don't want to shut them down. But at the same time, I would like to not also have a mini anxiety attack. It's a weird thing, you know, because I could be in the most hardcore situations back in the day and even today in certain situations that are extremely high pressure, very dynamic, very fluid, what people would consider extremely stressful, and I often thrive. And then I can be put in a situation where somebody is describing an imaginary world and it sends me into a nervous mess.
Because it's not really a problem, so there's no solution. So you feel like you're just stuck.
Hey, Chris, does it make you feel any better that the biggest radio station in Cincinnati, Ohio, has the same amount of technical problems that you have?
No, you know, it doesn't because...
Just so you know, it doesn't matter how much money you make, doesn't matter how much equipment you buy. No, they have a $27,000 mixer, and they still struggle with audio issues.
I follow you. I track you. See, that's just it. That is legitimately how it is at every size. And so we have these fantasies that like large radio stations really have their shit together, or Como really has their shit together. Yep. But the reality is that at every level, you just face another different set of scale problems.
No, it was basically the same thing. Audio was winding up in places they didn't want it. Audio wasn't coming into place.
And you still have electrical hum you got to fucking fight with. You still got all of the same things like software's buggy.
They didn't have any software, but or at least not but that I was I mean. Using. Like, but
software has bugs.
Yeah, it's all the same stuff. But it was funny because I was sitting here and I was like, you know, this is really, really nice. To me, anyway, because I was like, it doesn't. There, I know this is as good as it gets. Like, I know that there is nothing better, and they don't. I actually had less problems in Grand Forks than they were having there. So I was like, you know, really, all things considered, if that's the case, then I can just be like, okay, so JB is on par with, you know, budget wouldn't fix it. It's not like, oh, if we only had money, this would wouldn't. You'd still have problems.
You have a super depressing view of the world, Noah.
I don't think it's depressing at all. I think
depressing.
It's just those are the challenges of the industry, and so you either accept that those are the challenges of the industry or you don't, and then we can just move on.
Yeah, you accept that everything's shit, nothing can ever get better.
No, it gets better. It's just you're always going to have problems.
I have a blend of both your views. I see the world the way Noah sees it, and at the same time, I see the way the beard sees it, and my philosophy is work towards something better. And so with that, I want to say, as far as this studio goes, if Gnome wasn't crashing and if the final little issues with the mixer were worked out, this studio has gotten so solid with the recent transitions that, you know, it's like if I feel like doing something, it takes me a minute and I'm on the air. I'm on the air and I'm broadcasting in a minute, and it's nailed it every single time. The only hiccups we really have now are things that I think are solvable, like Gnome 3 crashing. Well, we're just going to have to replace Gnome Shell. I just haven't decided what yet. I'm
plasma.
Dragging my feet.
We're doing Plasma.
I just don't know. For my
purpose. That would be my suggestion, too.
I don't know if we need a desktop that heavy.
I agree with you. I agree with you. But you do need a desktop that supported and that well developed.
Yeah, and the other nice thing is now that I'm back to using Plasma as my main workstation desktop, it does sort of click to have the same interface in both places because it just makes me faster, and I can use it more intuitively, which is really useful when I'm on air and presenting.
Yeah.
So we solve that problem. We solve a couple of remaining issues with the mixer.
Which I am working on, by the way. In fact, I reached out to Behringer, and I'm waiting for them to get back to me. So it turns out there's like three very, very accepted ways to do what we're trying to do. And
we've done none of them.
No, we did. We kind of half did one, but it was one that followed off a YouTube video, so it wasn't exactly perfect. But now I know what to change. But here's the important part is I want to know from the horse's mouth, like, what do they recommend? I want to start from something that works, and then we can go and say, because everyone has their own reasons of why they didn't do it, you know, one way or the other. I want to start with something that works, and then we can go, okay, so this would make it better if we did this, and we can improve that. But like, start from something that actually even works to begin with.
Sure.
You know what really needs to happen is Behringer just needs to make an official tutorial series.
They have a class, actually, that you can attend. It's like a 1-week-long thing, and they show you how to do everything. That's a thing. And I actually thought about doing it, but I don't have the time. So,
The other kind of continuing technical challenge we're facing is because of a lack of hardware at the time and because we're always operating on a very tight budget, we decided to use the Librem 15 as the soundboard machine, which has just been progressively getting less stable. And it's not really clear why, because I don't frequently update the software. I don't really change anything. I think it's just heat, because it's just getting warmer out, and it doesn't properly cool. And so that's been crashing at least once a day. Sort those things out, though.
That Libra, I tell you.
That one is an easy drop-in replacement, though.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, we already, with the mixer, we're getting to a point of figuring out the problem and solution.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still serviceable, so we're still using it. It's working fine. The OBS crashing, well, once we replace GNOME 3, we've solved that. And then the soundboard crashing, once we replace the Librem, we've solved that. So we're damn close to being really solid. And then it's just going to be things like internet connectivity and power, which we don't really have a lot of control over. But I'm feeling pretty good as far as like stability-wise goes for the studio. Now I just want to go rebuild it all over again somewhere else. For some reason, I once you get it there, it's like, well, now how small can I make it? How simple can I make it? Can I build it all in the corner of my RV?
I don't know if you could do it in the corner of an RV, but we could definitely build that in like a 12x15 travel or like a 5x8 travel trailer or whatever, cargo trailer.
If there's one distro you shouldn't expect anything from, I think it's Fedora. So what's new in the new release, Chris?
Ouch. Wow. Massive burn. Yeah, I checked out Fedora 26 recently. I wasn't sure what I expected. And I got a lot of nothing. And at the same time, I think that's pretty much going to be great. Because Fedora 26 is just a simple, straightforward, almost stock GNOME desktop. And it got me thinking, like, well, what do I expect out of Fedora? And for some reason, with Canonical now shifting Ubuntu to use the GNOME desktop, it's made me relook at how I consider the Fedora desktop setup. And in some ways, it's more important than ever that there is a distro that is truly nearly stock GNOME. Like, do you follow what I'm saying? Like, it's almost... No, do you grok what I'm saying? It's almost like I feel like
I think that Fedora seems to be shifting in a good way, in a way that I support, from the let's take this as like software that we're kind of testing stuff on and getting ready to actually support RHEL to a full-on workstation-grade operating system. And that's kind of the shift that I've seen. And I guess to that end, I'm really, really happy that we're not finding a bunch of new stuff and a bunch of new crazy things. Let the other distros, let distros like Arch take care of that stuff, and let's have things like Fedora that, and let's transition Fedora into a workhorse that's supported by a major software vendor. I think that's a great thing.
I wonder if there was a discussion at all in the Fedora project that went something to the effect of, well, now that Canonical is going to be shipping GNOME, do we want to put our stamp on the GNOME desktop to make it more Fedora, to make it more branded Fedora?
I don't know. I feel like they've always kind of had a pretty stock...
Yeah, and I think now it's more important. It's going to be more important than ever because more and more we're seeing that Canonical is going to make modifications. They're going to put a theme on there. They're going to put certain extensions out of the box. They're going to be more aggressive with certain customizations to make it more in line with what Unity users expected. Like, that's why they're working on fractional scaling, stuff like that. And I think that's good. I don't think that's a bad thing at all. And I just think it's going to be kind of great in a sense, because we'll still have a distro that's like the go-to stock Linux. And if Copper took off, or Fedora, if Fedora just had a little more software availability, I think it could actually be a good workstation for someone like you, Beard, even though you're skeptical. I actually think it's a pretty good distro to consider if you didn't want to go Arch for some reason and you wanted to run either a pretty stock Plasma desktop or a stock GNOME desktop. I think it's actually a pretty decent distro. You disagree?
I don't have much to say about that. I mean, I'm sure it's
you would never consider it.
I'd consider it, but I probably wouldn't switch to it. Like, it offers no real advantages to me and a bunch of downsides. Like, if I go with Arch, I get updates that are pretty much always up to date. With Fedora, if I want to do the same thing, I have to get into stuff like Copper and all that stuff.
Yes.
And it gets super convoluted really quickly.
But where the difference is in Arch, there's no master maintainer. There's no real distribution maintaining happening there. See, with Fedora, there's actually a group of people crafting a project, and so there is some amount of cohesiveness and technical direction that the distribution goes in that does come across as a solid, cohesive product, where Arch comes across as like a car kit that you build yourself and are always kind of replacing certain parts on.
Well,
I would agree with all that. I would also add to that the design philosophy behind Fedora is they are aware that a large measurable portion of their own employee, their bottom line, is being supported by Fedora. So if they break something, if something doesn't work properly, it could drastically affect operations at Red Hat. And so to that end, there is a cost factor to trying new things and moving, you know, and not being stable, I guess.
No, they do try new things though.
Yeah, they do. I just think it may be more carefully controlled than maybe it would be with Arch. I'll give you a perfect example of this. So I have a C-File. I love C-File. And one of the things with C-File is every time they update something with OpenSSL in Entergos, it breaks C-File. And if you look at the Arch wiki, basically everyone has just kind of accepted that the answer to that is just to uninstall C-File and reinstall it, which isn't really the end of the world. It's two commands, and it keeps all of the data there. It's annoying. And the other thing is, too, is like at no time does anyone recognize that if you're using C-File for your business and this doesn't work, then you just don't have data until you put this magical incarnation to get it back. And I think those are the kind of problems that you wouldn't necessarily run into with Fedora.
See, and the counter argument I would have is that you would get the same problem in the opposite direction with Fedora, where, say, Fedora doesn't update packages quickly enough and you try to install an app and it needs a newer version of the library than you have,
yes.
Then you have to go and you have to start messing with Copper and you don't even know if those will be maintained by whoever the hell is maintaining whatever.
That's true.
So that's true.
I think those are going to be fringe cases. That's going to be software that's not used in the mainstream. I think
most of the software I use.
Well, it could be could be taken off. Copper might become less of a player as Flatpaks and Snaps become more accepted, or Appian.
Yeah, that too. Yeah
true. But that's not now, so.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a down.
We're pretty close.
So I'm probably going to switch to Solus. I think I'm probably going to switch to Solus. I was considering KDE Neon because I'm really enjoying the Plasma desktop, and that's a great way to get Plasma. But I really have to consider the core, motivations behind the project. And the KDE Neon project is really about showcasing Plasma and about really pushing the Plasma desktop forward, and not so much about building a holistic, great workstation. And that's totally fine.
Did you look at the Netrunner distros at all?
Yeah, I didn't, just because it was between Arch and Solus really for me at that point.
Fair enough.
And so I was kind of like, that's either way. But Netrunner did look really. I kind of intended to still kind of give it a go before today's episode, but I just didn't get a chance. So I think I might still. But I could see a future. I don't think it's now, but I could see a future where I could see Fedora. I can still see it. I don't know if it'd be the GNOME desktop, but I could see me with a Plasma version of Fedora using flat packs or snaps. I could see it. I could also, though, at the same time, see Ubuntu LTS 18.04 GNOME desktop, assuming some of these – I actually have – I have faith that these crash issues I'm having with GNOME are going to go away. I wouldn't be surprised if they're gone by the next release even, or by the time 18.04 ships. And then, you know, I could also see myself switching to that. It's a weird period of time for me right now. It's weird because – so the thing is that happened to me is because Noah, you missed – you were gone a week. I did an update and now my GNOME desktop doesn't log in. This has happened once before to me, and it's one of those things where I could probably go find the extension or I could go
– Wasn't it fonts last time?
Yeah, it was a font last time. Yep. I could go find the font package or whatever. Like, you know, there's a whole litany of lists, things that could just – one thing breaks. You have – there's even been a – I even had a problem once where I tried the Mint icon, the new Mint icon themes on Arch, and some of the icons were corrupt, and that caused the entire GNOME desktop to shit itself. So I just at that point, I just on my login manager, just chose Plasma, logged in, and it's been working just fine.
Yeah. See, that kind of speaks to why I distrust GNOME, because it speaks to how much of a house of cards it is that if you're missing a font or an icon, that the entire desktop just won't launch.
Yeah. Yeah. In full fairness, in the past, had the same thing happen to me on Plasma, and that's why I went back to GNOME.
Okay, fair enough.
That's been many releases ago, and now I think it's been exactly four releases.
Let's go start deleting fonts and see if it breaks.
four upgrades now on one system. I've upgraded to Plasma from whatever it is. It's on the latest.
And some
now,
of those updates, you didn't even log into it, I imagine.
Yeah, no, I was on GNOME. So it's been pretty steady and pretty reliable. When I logged back in, it was like I never left. It's pretty inviting. Did you see that Ikey went full-time on Solus? Or he's going full-time? He just gave his notice at Intel.
Awesome.
I didn't realize that he worked at Intel.
Yeah, well, he was the maintainer of Clear Linux and Clear Boot Manager, which are very great projects, like really well-built. Projects that I didn't realize initially that Ikey was involved in that I had already had respected and kind of understands now. I kind of understand a little bit better now why Solus is as far as long as it is because it's not his first rodeo.
Mm-hmm.
He developed, of course, Evolve OS, but also he's worked with other projects outside of just his own distributions for years and then created Clear Linux and the Clear Boot Manager and now Solus. So it's not like he's never done this before. But going full-time, that's a big commitment to a project like that. And I think it'll make a big difference. I think it's going to be probably even more competitive. So that's kind of why I'm considering making the jump.
Getting on early.
Yeah. And it's like, wow.
Covering it as it grows.
Not that I didn't think he took it seriously, but for some reason, it just seems...
It felt like a toy distro.
Well, it felt like it was... You know, it was something that it could eventually have to end if life got tough or something like that. But now it's like,
see, that was so. It's interesting you say that because that was one of the things that I was like, you know, just very early on. I'm like, look at all the distros that are around, and the chances of Solus being around in 10 years. What realistically is the chance of that happening? And obviously, like you said, it kind of changes the whole playing field now.
The only reason why I don't let that – I do that always as a factor when – especially the larger the project or the more important it is to my work. But the thing is you can't really let that be the measuring stick you measure most open source by, because a lot of open source is people's passion projects that might not be around.
Mm-hmm. I'm fine with passion projects. I just like passion projects. Like, you know, like look at the Ardour guy, right? Like he did it full time. If he started as a pet project, then he did it full time. Then he went back to part time or whatever. But like, it's been around for so long that it's not going anywhere. Even if he himself decides not to do it. If Ikey tomorrow just said, I'm done with Solus, what are the chances that it would get picked back up and continued?
I don't know, but what would be the downside of that?
Downside of what?
So what would be the negative side effects? So say Ikey says, you know what, fuck it, I'm done doing Solus. You know, sorry, you know, he's got a whole team underneath him. You guys can keep going if you want, but say the entire team says, all right, I'm done too without Ikey. There's no point. Mm-hmm. It would seem like the worst case is then I just install a different distro, right? I mean, I'm not trying to undersell it.
I follow you, but the thing is,
my cloud infrastructure on it or something. It's just
right.
It's just
I guess. To me, if I could just install another distro, if there was something else I was as happy with, I would just assume to go there and avoid the change to begin with. One of the things that excites me about Solus is if he ever gets to a point where that is a where it is a solid desktop environment that has all of the or at least the majority of the features of, you know, like the bigger distros or whatever, I'd consider switching it to it full time because just to have something that is focused on the Linux desktop, not in phones and TVs and whatever else, and yeah, not just
or yeah, even servers or even servers.
Right. Even servers. Yeah. Yeah. So
I like that aspect of it.
Yeah. Me too.
I'll tell you something else that Solus is doing that's it's really hard to understand, and I'm not trying to be demeaning. I'm just saying it's if you don't use the distro, it's you don't really pick up on it. Is Solus is willing to solve problems that are harder than flavors tackle. So, with the exception of some of our favorite flavors out there, they're essentially just re-spinning off an Ubuntu, changing a few things, and they're not really solving like core issues. Like one of the things Solus has solved is really bulletproof kernel upgrades. Like that is a hard problem and required the clear boot manager and a total swap out of how all of that's like it was a deep technical problem that, dare I say it, required actual engineering to solve. And it wasn't some bash script that could be changed. It wasn't something that could be patched. It wasn't a surface level detail. It was something that required something at the distribution level, at the maintainer level. It required something at the packaging level. It required something at the lower OS level and the boot manager level. And it was a true technical problem that needed to be solved. That now they handle kernel upgrades. I think the best. I think they have the best kernel upgrades out of all the
my only remaining issue with Solus is it seems like every time there's an issue, every time you come across something, the answer is, well, we're not quite there yet. I mean, we're going to get there, but we're not quite there yet. To which my answer is, well, then it's not complete. So when it's complete, let me know, and then I'll be willing to switch.
Yeah, I mean, if you're running into that, for sure.
I think the way I looked at Solus before was it's always been a step above respins, but it hasn't been on the level of the major distributions,
right?
Because there's nobody putting their full focus on it, and I feel like Aiki is the first step towards making that. Yeah. Like it used to punch above its weight class,
yeah,
and now I feel like it's starting to become one of those. Big
isn't
distros.
That the thing though? Okay, so if it could punch above its weight class when it's his part-time project, what's that going to do when how's it going to shift when it's full time? Here's the other thing is he's got good people working for him. Like each person that he's put in makes a lot of sense. And I'm a little biased because Josh is one of them, but Josh is a longtime community member of Jupiter Broadcasting. He's a good guy. And as soon as he got associated with that project, I was like, that makes a lot of sense. Josh is a really good communicator and he's done very effective work for the project. They're very well communicated. You really know where they're at. And on top of that, they communicate well with their patrons too. So all of that is sort of like the recipe, I think, for a very successful Linux distro. And then, after Linux Unplugged last week, we had a little conversation about the Budgie 11 desktop and about how he's rebuilding it on Qt. And I asked him, are you going to use Kwin for Budgie 11? And he's like, yeah, well, why reinvent the wheel? It's great. Kwin is great. We talked about how great Kwin is for a bit. And so he's going to be using that on Budgie 11, and he could potentially be making a totally Qt compliant, fits right in with the Plasma desktop applications, uses Kwin for the rendering, but is much smoother and simpler. And there's big pieces missing still. Like I asked him, what are you going to use for the file manager? He doesn't quite know yet because he also has some usability concerns with Dolphin, it sounded like. He didn't really elaborate, but it sounded like he had some concerns. So there's missing pieces. It's not there yet. But the direction he's going, oh man, it really is. It pushes all my buttons because it's everything I like about the Plasma desktop with a simpler, cleaner, more dare I say, GNOME shell like interface.
I think Aiki has a good sense of when you need to reinvent the wheel and when you can build on existing projects. And I think that's part of what has drawn me towards Solus, even though I haven't committed to using it. I think that more than most other people and most other companies, he is really good at deciding when to throw stuff away and start from scratch and when to continue on with something.